Marvelous. Right, let's get started today. Welcome to our latest Employment Law 101. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We are based in the south of England, but we work with businesses that are all over the world and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. And that's where we help them. Delighted as always to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
For what today is the last 101 session of 2025.
Where's the year gone?
I
It's
know
frightening to hear you say that.
it's gone in the blink of an eye. I feel a bit rusty on this, but I think it's only 2 weeks since our last session, but it feels like it's been a month in terms of how busy we have been. Plenty going on. I'm sure all of you that are joining today are super busy as well with one thing or another in the world in which we work. We are going to be back here in early January, so just a little break over Christmas. We're going to have three episodes to upload Spotify, so lots of information for you to get into and listen to over the Christmas period, perhaps when you've been stuffed full of turkey and you need a break from the in-laws or whatever it might be. You can
Probably
go
for
and have a little
Sissa.
listen to our past
Yeah,
recordings. What are we talking about today? Well, we wanted to do like a 2025 Wrapped. I mean, shamelessly stolen from Spotify, right?
absolutely. Although my Spotify was woeful, according to my children. So hopefully this will be a bit more of interest to everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. My Spotify gave me a listening age of 77, I think, which I was a little bit concerned about. But skirting around that, the hot topic, what we're going to kick off with right now is the Employment Rights Bill, because for weeks and weeks and weeks, we've been saying, when is it happening? Is it going to be now? We almost thought it was going to be yesterday. It very nearly went through yesterday, but the Lords voted down an amendment. Just want to bring you up to speed in terms of where we are with the Employment Rights Bill. It might go through before Christmas, it might not, but we're into the kind of the weeds of the sticking points or sticking point. Simply, it's about unfair dismissal compensation. That's what the bun fight is on now. But just park that for a second, because let's just take a step back and talk about what's changed since we last opined on the Employment Rights Bill. Confession time, I was certain that day one unfair dismissal rights were going to go through because of, I foolishly believed all of the absolute certainties that the ministers were saying, even, as recently as the 5th of November in Parliament, where an under minister stood up and said, no, 6 months qualification period is absolutely not going to happen because that doesn't give people the day one rights that we want to give them. Lo and behold, there has been a change. And actually, I mean, my personal view is it's a positive change. What is happening now is that the qualifying period for unfair dismissal is not going to be day one. So breathe a sigh of relief. It is no longer going to be 2 years like it is at the moment. It will, in fact, be 6 months. So employees need 6 months continuous employment to be able to bring an unfair dismissal claim. So quite a big
That's
shift
quite a balance,
happening.
though, isn't it? Really,
I
if
think
you think
so.
about it. I mean, certainly when I first started practicing, it was 2 years. Then it came down to 12 months. Then it bumped back up to 2 years. And I think, the world of work has changed. People don't tend to stay in jobs for that long. I mean, certainly before all the redundancies going on. So it feels that it's more of a compromise for sure. But yeah, I'm so relieved it's not going to be day one.
No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think it was going to be chaos. Now, because it's not going to be day one anymore, and it's going to be 6 months. And you and I were talking about this previously, Adrienne. There are knock-on helpful consequences, which means that actually the timeline for implementation of this particular change may be accelerated now from autumn of 2027 to 1st of January 2020. Sorry. 1st of January 2027 instead of autumn 2027. I nearly said 2026 then, which would be a bit scary. What it means is that that time is going to come round quite quickly. I mean, we're talking about potentially, just over 12 months if it does go ahead as rumoured. So if you're thinking about employees that you're taking on from July of 2026, so in 6 or 7 months' time, actually, by the time this becomes law and implemented on the 1st of January 2027, and again, that's just a rumor, but that's what we're hearing, then those employees you're hiring in 6 or 7 months' time will have accrued the right to be able to bring an unfair dismissal claim if they're then terminated, if the law's implemented in that way. So it's going to start to have consequences quite soon. The reason it can be accelerated is ACAS Code of Practice doesn't need to be amended anymore. I mean, that was the whole thing about day one rights and statutory probation periods, wasn't it, Adrienne? It was like the mechanics of how it was going to work.
Yeah, and there was also that whole thing around, well, you know, if we're going to have this statutory probationary period with a light touch process, what was that going to look like? How was that going to be reflected in both the law and, as you said, the ACAS code? But that's all going to go because there's no longer a need for a statutory probationary period anymore, is there?
No, absolutely. But it does prompt it, it prompts other discussions now, doesn't it? And in fact, I was at a client site yesterday, having a good chat with the HR team about this particular change. And this particular business has a 6 month probation period already. Well, how do you square 6 month probation period with unfair dismissal rights after 6 months in a situation where managers might not be the most proactive in terms of actually following a probationary framework review, if you even have a probation framework review, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everything we've been saying in previous episodes about making sure that your onboarding and your probationary period is well structured, etc., that's all going to be good stuff, right? Because that's going to drive whether or not there is going to be fairness when you're talking about these rights coming in. So to that extent, everything that we've said about making sure that your managers are aware, making sure that they have got a good framework, that there are regular catch-ups, all of that good stuff that we talked about is going to become even more important, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that doesn't go away. And for those of you that we've been talking to, you may have attended our other sessions. That's right. That's been the message. It's like you've still got that window of opportunity. It might be a smaller window now, given the restricted time scale that's rumoured, but you've still got that window of opportunity to do a big education piece in terms of educating line managers in particular, who are often the ones on the front line in terms of managing probation periods, about why it's really critical to get that right. I mean, the stick is avoiding liability for unfair dismissal and everything that goes with that, but there's a big carrot as well with this, which is just doing business decently, doing the right thing, treating people fairly, and being transparent in terms of your processes as well, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, if we look at it from the other side of the coin as well, you've probably spent a significant amount of money and time in getting these people into your business. This in place sets people up for success and then doesn't waste that time or money. So if you look at it in the positive light that way, it's not just about, you know, being on the defensive foot. It's about being right, we've got this person on board. Let's make sure that they absolutely smash it.
Yeah, set up for success. So to recap, 6 month qualification period for unfair dismissal. The bun fight is about compensation for unfair dismissal claims. So let's just talk for a few minutes about that. Now, at the moment, there's a cap on compensation, and well, there's kind of two caps, really. The way it works at the moment is that if you bring an unfair dismissal claim, the most you can qualify, most you can claim for in terms of compensation for lost earnings is either approximately £118,000. I might be a few pounds out on that, but let's say it's £118,000 in terms of the cap, or 52 weeks gross pay, so the amount you earn over a year, whichever is the lower of those two things. So if you're earning 30, 40, 50,000, the maximum you can claim is 30, 40, or 50,000. If you are a high earner and you earn £180,000 a year, then the amount you can recover is capped at that £118,000 figure. Now, the controversial change is to remove that cap on compensation completely, which has obviously got quite a lot of people concerned. Because if you think about when you're negotiating severance agreements, be it, protected conversation, you're having a discussion with someone about can we part company, but let's stay friends, we'd like to pay you some money. Or if you're in a situation where you've dismissed somebody and you're facing an unfair dismissal claim, there's a fairly known quantity in terms of what your what your
what you're in
risk is,
for.
what your commercial risk is, yeah, what you're in for. And you can make a quite a straightforward calculation about what is your budget, what's your appetite to pay that, knowing that you're going to hit this cap at some point. If that goes, how do you then factor that into negotiations? That's a
I
big
mean, it
question.
is a big question, but also, if for example, when we're advising individuals, which we do, not as often as we used to, but sometimes we get people coming to us and they're high earners, and they've got potential unfair dismissal claims because they might have been made redundant or they've had a protected conversation. We can often look at the agreement, see the sums that are being offered, and say, well, look, there may well have been, you may well have an unfair dismissal claim, but the amount on offer is well above the cap already. So you'd be better off taking the money and running, because otherwise you're stuck in an employment tribunal process, which we'll come on to later. And the chances of you getting anything more than that are going to be less. And you might even get less because you're under a duty to mitigate your loss. So in that sense, this certainty acts on both sides. Whereas if we're taking the cap off, then there's going to be an awful lot more potentially up for stake and up for negotiations. But that was, as I understand it, that was sort of like a bit of a compromise, wasn't it, in order to get a meeting of the minds on the unfair dismissal period.
Yeah, well, this is where it all gets a little bit grey, because the compromise on day one unfair dismissal rights came about as a result of some meeting between government and trade union representatives, or representatives of trade union organisations and business representatives as well. And for anybody that is a fan of the musical Hamilton, you'll know there's a piece in there about being in the room where the discussions happened, and no one really know well. Obviously, the people who were in the room know what was discussed, but none of us really know what those discussions were. And the stuff that I've read suggests that business leaders didn't agree to a complete removal of the cap. I saw a post, and I can't remember who posted this on LinkedIn, but there was a comment from somebody prominent in the business community who said their understanding of the discussion was that the removal of the cap related to the lower amount. So you would just have a cap of, say, £118,000 on compensation. It wasn't a
Right.
complete removal of the cap in its with no cap applying at all. And that's quite a significant point of difference for the reasons that we've just been talking about. So that's the issue that is currently being voted down by the House of Lords. And I saw an article in the paper this morning saying from the trade unions saying, why the House of Lords going against the will of the people? Labour were elected on a manifesto pledge, and this employment rights bill has been debated and scrutinised for so long now. Why are they suddenly, trying to defy the will of the people, and they should just vote it through? Which I thought was a little bit unfair, because actually it's not been voted through because of this compensation change, and this compensation change is like a week old.
Yeah, it was
You know,
never mentioned
it's
before.
never been mentioned before.
No.
So quite how this resolves itself, we don't know. We're just back in that ping pong phase where it's back at the House of Commons, but it just seems like this is the last sticking point.
And I think the other thing to remember, of course, that there's currently no cap on compensation for discrimination claims or whistleblowing claims, etc. It's only for unfair dismissal claims that there is the current cap. And somebody's just asked the question, will employees still be required to mitigate their loss? Yes, that still applies, because the whole compensation for loss of earnings in the employment tribunals is exactly that. It's to compensate employees for the losses they've suffered as a result of losing their jobs. It's not like the US, where it's punitive damages or anything like that. So, as I've often said to people, employees can be treated absolutely appallingly in an unfair dismissal process, and the compensation is the same, i.e., if you can't get a job until 6 months in, you'll get 6 months' pay. If you can't get a job for a year, then you'll get a year's pay, subject obviously to the current cap. So the duty to mitigate will still remain. And we've talked about this before when we did a session on remedies, where the burden is on the employers to demonstrate that the employee could have mitigated their loss. So if you want to go back and remind yourself of what we talked about, then it's on one of our episodes. And off the top of my head, I can't remember which one it is. But it'll be on
That's okay.
Spotify.
There's about 78 of them on
Yeah.
Spotify and Amazon Music now, so
Yeah.
go and have a listen to them. It's probably worth quickly mentioning Polkey arguments as well, still, right? It's still open to employers to say, had we got things correct, it would have made no difference, or and contribution arguments as well to fault. So there are other
Yeah.
means of chipping around, but there's just going to be a load more uncertainty. That's all.
It's also worth pointing out as well that I think the stats show that, in actual fact, while the most cases actually end up in awards with far less than the cap. So I think it's probably less about what will happen to awards in the employment tribunal when the cases go the whole way. It's more about how employers go about, assessing the potential damage, deciding on what processes or not to follow when looking at dismissals, and just trying to plan and map out any potential liability. But certainly the stats show that unfair dismissal case compensation is a lot less.
Yeah. We've had a couple of questions just about probation periods as well. Someone's asked in the Q&A, and I see someone's just put something in the chat about what's happening with the probation periods. We think they're still going to be unchanged. I mean, the question that somebody's asked is we've got some staff on 6 month probation periods and some on 12 months. There are good reasons for this. Will that still be okay? I think the short answer is yes, that is still okay. But bear in mind, if you've got someone who's on a 12-month probation period, they will have accrued the right to bring an unfair dismissal claim after 6 months. So if you're dismissing them in month 12, perfectly legitimately, having followed a fair process, I guess you're going to be saying it's on the grounds of capability, the fair reason. They're going to be able to bring an unfair dismissal claim against you if they feel that the decision is an unfair one. So you're
Yeah.
going to have liability there.
And we've always talked about probationary periods. And again, I think this episode was a long, long time ago, years ago, where we talked about the pros and cons of probationary periods. But very often it's a useful tool to give a message to the employees that, they're essentially being A, supported, which is important, but also monitored during that period. So it's a case of making sure that they are, they need to be on top of their game during that period, at the very least. So it's just that the statutory probationary period that had been mooted as part of this Employment Rights Bill is no longer going to be a thing.
No. So, if you go back and listen to some of the other episodes we've got on the Employment Rights Bill, a lot of what we've talked about in those, aside from unfair dismissal stuff, is unchanged. It's pretty much accurate. So go back and have a listen to those ones, because there's all sorts of, we've got like 20 plus other provisions. So there's all sorts of stuff about trade union things which you should listen to, even if you're not in a unionised environment, because of the nature of the changes, they might impact you in the future. Shall we move on and just talk about short
And
service
trends.
dismissals and
Yeah.
some of the trends that we've seen in 2025.
And this is kind of relevant to what we've been talking about because, there's definitely been a trend of people who have been dismissed who don't currently have the qualifying period of service, bringing claims for discrimination, for whistleblowing. Basically, I think we've said this before on previous episodes that, they look for ways in which to get around this qualifying period of service. So employers are facing claims for, you dismissed me not because of anything that I did wrong or that I didn't perform properly, but because of my race, because of my religion, because I complained about discrimination, all these types of claims. Because if you remember, discrimination claims do not require any qualifying period of service. And that is certainly one of the biggest trends in terms of tribunal claims that we've seen in the last few years. Whether or not that's going to be impacted by this change remains to be seen, particularly if the cap on compensation comes off. But certainly one of the messages we've been giving out to anybody is that, irrespective of their length of service, just be a bit careful in thinking, oh, we're safe to dismiss. Because very often you may not be, not necessarily because you have discriminated against, but remembering that employees are going to be looking to bring those types of claims. And you need to be able to put yourself in the best possible decision to be able to defend the claim when it's brought. So having some kind of process, some kind of transparency in terms of what you are doing that leads to the dismissal is a really, really good idea. So you can say, here's everything we did. Here's our brilliant probationary period process where we set objectives, we gave you support, we gave you everything that you needed, and here's the conversations that we've had about you not quite making the mark. And finally, obviously, when you get to the point of dismissal, it's always a good idea just to invite them to a meeting to give them the heads up, give them examples of what's led to that conversation. And there are two reasons for it, as I said. The first one is to defend the claims, which is always useful because we all know that we can't stop employees from bringing the claims. They're free. You fill in an online form, it's really, really easy. And then you are caught in litigation. And the second reason you might want to do it is because you have to imagine what it looks like to an employment tribunal. Now, as it stands, even if employees don't have the rights to bring a claim for unfair dismissal, tribunal panels are made up of humans, and they are always going to be looking at fairness. So yes, they might not be able to give unfair dismissal rights in favour of the employee, but if you want to put yourself in the best possible position, just consider that human reaction when they see that you've followed a fair process, irrespective of service, because they will go, well, okay, this all looks fair to me. This looks like a decent employer. And it just helps to move the needle a little bit, just in terms of what the tribunal might be thinking you of you as an employer. Same principle applies to conduct. You know, we've talked about performance and probationary periods, etc. But you know, it's always best to do citation. Make sure the employee has a very clear, even if you're looking at dismissing rather than potentially, you know, giving a warning, which you might do for somebody who's got service. All of that just looks like, well, the tribunal looks at you as an employer and says, well, you were really clear with the employee. You've got good policies. You gave them notice. You gave them the chance to explain themselves, and you treated them fairly. So, you know, it's a question of looking at it not just from the strict legal rights position, but how you might come across at a tribunal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's really important. And we've seen more issues around taking a more robust approach. But you know, there is a time and a place for that. But it's about kind of being able to make an informed decision, isn't it? Shall I just talk a little bit about neurodiversity, Adrienne? So
Big increase.
yeah, so again, something we've seen in 2025 is, you know, the rise of individuals, not just employees, but across society who are being diagnosed and who are neurodiverse. And we're not just talking about in the workplace as such, because you know, you just have to read in the newspapers and online about schools and how they're having to adapt and modify things as well. But for us, this has to be one of the kind of key topics of 2025, and you know, what we've seen lots of businesses struggling with in terms of, you know, how to address issues that are arising. So what sort of stuff have we been seeing this year? Well, a big spike in the number of employees disclosing neurodiversity, you know, which is great that they feel able to do that, and you know, have those discussions, and perhaps discussions that people would have been reluctant to have 5 or 10 years ago. Lots of employees coming forward and saying, "I need you to be aware, employer, that I've been diagnosed with." And then, in terms of other issues, employees not disclosing that they may have a diagnosis, but it comes out later as part of a claim. And so that brings about the issue of masking and, you know, what some employees might do within the workplace because they don't have the confidence to raise this stuff to their employer for whatever reason. And, you know, masking as well presents own issues, certainly in terms of ill health and time off for sickness, where people are just completely burnt out from feeling that they need to mask certain conditions within the workplace. So we've done quite a bit of work with some organizations about that, you know, primarily in terms of educating line managers about spotting the signs and, you know, how to adapt and how to cope if they're dealing with somebody who they believe is masking or they believe his work has been impacted in a negative way. We've also seen lots of issues arising from difficulties between colleagues, and that really manifests itself in grievances and very long grievances or long and repetitive grievances as well. So they can present a real practical challenge in terms of management, as does performance and conduct issues as well, which also require, you know, really careful management and support. I mean, I think the good news is that there's absolutely loads of really, really helpful guidance and information that's available. So ACAS earlier this year released a study and loads of supporting material in respect of neurodiversity in the workplace. So if you haven't had a chance to dip into that information already, then I really recommend you do, because there's some really good practical takeaway points in there. But if you've got time to read the report that underpins that support, it's really worthwhile digging into it, because there's lots of very revealing statistics that I think CIPD collated about neurodiversity within the workplace, and just you know, how many people would identify as being neurodiverse, and what employers, you know, are having to think about in terms of addressing that. So have a look at the ACAS guidance on that, because I think it's really, really useful. This is an area that we're expecting to continue to develop into 2026. So there isn't a quick fix solution to this. It really does require adaptation and education of people within the workplace, in terms of business practice going forwards. The primary risk, kind of underpinning all of it, bring it back to kind of pure employment law principles, is the scope for disability discrimination issues. And the reason for that are things like ADHD, autism, ADD. They'll often be conditions which count as disabilities under the Equality Act. So I don't know if you're able just to speak a little bit about reasonable adjustments and how that works.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, and this is, you know, we see a variety of things. We see employers coming forward, for example, saying an employee's come to us and said that, you know, they're struggling with certain things, time management, prioritizing tasks, etc. They've got ADHD. How do we support them? And, you know, I think that's a really it's a really, really good question. So from a legal perspective, once you're, you know, that an employee has and that might be a disability, or you should reasonably be aware that they have, you've got this duty to make reasonable adjustments. Now, on the other side of things, we see employees coming forward going, "You can't do this to me. I've got ADHD, that's a disability, etc." And I think it's always worth reminding yourselves and the employees that absolutely fine, we can make reasonable adjustments, but the purpose of those adjustments is to level the playing field to make sure the employee is successful in their role. It is not an excuse as to why they can't do their job. So it's always like the first port of call should be, right, my duty is to make reasonable adjustments. Let's figure out what adjustments might be needed to help the employee be successful. Well, how do we do that? Well, occupational health is most likely going to be your friend here, because they will produce a report which sets out what the impact is of the condition and will make recommendations in terms of adjustments. And if any of you have ever had occupational health reports, there's often a bit in there which says, "Oh, we recommend these adjustments, but of course it's a business and management decision as to whether or not they're reasonable." And you know, we get asked all the time, "Well, what's a reasonable adjustment?" Well, it depends on your business, it depends on your size, it depends on your resources, and it depends on the nature of the job. And it could be as simple as making sure that somebody has sufficient breaks, maybe giving them noise cancelling headphones, for example. Helping them with, you know, task sheets, helping them prioritize things, giving them duties which are similar, a clump together is one that we see quite a lot, because the employee can then get into the focus and do similar tasks together. So occupational health is one. And also there's no substitute, obviously, for talking to the employee saying, "Okay, talk to me about how this impacts you. Let's have a discussion about how we can, you know, what adjustments might help you to be successful in your role." Once those adjustments are in place and it's all agreed, then the employee's performance can be monitored in exactly the same way as everybody else. But if you don't put those adjustments in place, you are going to face some difficulties in doing a performance management process. So I think that's one part of the legal process. You could end up facing a claim for failure to make reasonable adjustments. The second part is what we would call a Section 15 claim. And this is where you end up dismissing somebody for something that arises out of their disability. So it's the discrimination arising from claim. And that might be you dismiss somebody because they persistently don't come to work on time, or it might be something related to their conduct. And if the employee can link that something to their disability, then potentially you're on the receiving end of a claim for discrimination unless you can justify it. So, you know, what can we be doing as employers and as supporting people? Well, we've talked a lot about having supportive policies in place, implementing training, dealing with issues that might arise at an early stage to see what can be accommodated. And I think the other thing to remember as well, we talked about difficulties with colleagues who sometimes might find it difficult to accept, you know, issues that might be conduct issues. Think about training colleagues and making them aware of you know, neurodiversity in the workplace. But yeah, those are some of the points. On a positive note, of course, neurodiverse employees can bring an enormous amount of value to your organization because of the way they think, how they can operate. You know, if they're in the right role and they're supported, it can be massively successful.
I think, one of the best things that I got involved in this year was about 6 weeks ago, and that was, you know, teaming up with a client's HR team. We had about 100 line managers from around the country on a call. We had a neurodiversity expert on the call as well, and we were just kind of doing an education piece around what lived experience of neurodiversity is like, which is really revealing, and reassuring the line managers that there's support in place to help manage things, and that this stuff isn't going away. You have to just adapt because it is now the new normal. And we did a poll at the start of the session and a poll at the end of the session in terms of how confident the managers felt about understanding and being able to manage these issues. And it was really, great to see the needle move in terms of a lot more confidence by the end of the session. And, just teaming up with the neurodiversity expert, I felt I learned loads, loads of practical stuff on that. So that education and training piece is really valuable, and you can get immediate results from doing something like that as well. But yeah, that was a highlight of training for me this year. I'm mindful of the time that we've got available. We're going to overrun very slightly. So thanks to all of you that are still sticking around. Shall we just have a last word about tribunals and ACAS and
Tribunals.
what we're seeing in that space? It's
I
busy,
mean,
isn't it?
it is busy. The system is absolutely overloaded. And for those of you who are involved in any claims, you'll know there's an enormous backlog. A word about ACAS as well. And what we've encountered with ACAS is that they are just swamped. When I'm speaking to ACAS officers, the is it absolutely enormous, and they're doing that with all the early conciliation referrals. But the numbers are huge. I'm sure many of you will have had contact from ACAS who probably said to you, "I'm really sorry that it's taken me so long to get in touch with you now, but we're already 4 weeks into the mandatory 6-week conciliation period, which can't be extended by law." So for those of you that know already, sorry about this, but for those of you that don't, before an employee can lodge a tribunal claim, they have to notify ACAS. And there is this 6-week conciliation period during which time a deal tries to be brokered
I can
between the
give you some good
parties.
news, Adrian. It's 12 weeks now.
Oh,
It's
12
yeah,
weeks.
it's been doubled. I mean, not that I think it will really change things other than
Well, I
the
think
labor
what will
needs
happen
and
is that
increase.
ACAS will literally phone up and say, "I'm sorry, it's 10 weeks into the
Yeah.
early conciliation period, and we've
Poor
only got
ACAS.
2 weeks left." I know, I do feel sorry for them. I have been told by an ACAS officer that more resources are going to be made available, but they don't know what that looks like yet. But the same thing applies to tribunals. So, to give you an example, this week we have had two cases listed, and the one's been listed for, I think it's the summer of 2029. And another has been listed for the summer of 2028 with a preliminary hearing. So, that's the initial case management hearing not being listed until autumn next year, which, look, I mean, it's access meant to be access to justice for the employees, and that really isn't the case. And the tribunal system's having a really, really tough time right now. But what does that actually mean for you as employers? I mean, you might think, "Oh, phew, we won't have to worry about it for a few years. That's fantastic. All the rest of it, you can deal with it later. You can put your pens down. You can focus on concentrating on running the business." And of course, an element of that is true. But the one tip that we would give to you is still make sure that you get prepared. Particularly when it's things like gathering your documents. So in 2 years' time, will you still have access to the if you still have access to the documents and also your witnesses? So, think about who your witnesses are going to be now. It's well worth getting them set up, talking about witness statements, making sure you've got things in place right now, because memories fade. Okay, memories do fade, but also you don't even know whether those key witnesses will still be working for you when it comes to the tribunal. So think about that very carefully. If one of your key witnesses is going to be leaving the organization for whatever reason, can you get some kind of commitment from them that they'll still be a witness? Because the impact of not doing this can be the difference in whether or not you're able to successfully defend your claim. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. And I suppose the only other thing to add on that is that tribunals will very often send out a set of directions. And by that, I mean, you will exchange documents by this date, you will exchange witness statements by this date. They'll often send that out far ahead of any hearing. So, it may be that the final hearing is many years away, but the preparation might well be ordered to be done by the tribunal a lot sooner.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the meantime, we'll see whether there are additional resources deployed into the Employment Tribunal Service. But I think the government have got bigger fish to fry at the moment. Elaine says, leave it to David Lammy; he'll sort it out. Yeah, maybe. Cynthia asked about tribunal cases from non-employees, someone placing a case about discrimination in recruitment activity. Yeah, people are protected in terms of not being discriminated against during the recruitment process. You don't need to be to have been employed to be able to bring a claim under the Equality Act. I think I'm trying to remember. I've certainly done training on it. I'm just trying to remember if we did a 101 session. I think we might have done in
We
terms of
did.
avoiding discrimination in recruitment. So if you have a
Yeah.
look on Spotify or Amazon Music or Apple Podcasts, search for Employment Law 101. You'll find all of our back episodes. If you want to watch us, the video recordings are on the NPM Legal website, which is npmlegal.co.uk. I said at the head of the call today, I think we're going to have three episodes to upload ahead of the Christmas break, so you can listen to your heart's content. That's it from us for 2025. So a massive thank you to everybody that supported the podcast, and we've had a couple of emails recently with suggestions for topics for 2025. So thank you to those people, and we'll certainly take you up on your suggestions as well. If anyone else has got any burning topics you'd like us to look at in 2026, then please just drop us a line as well. Otherwise, have an absolutely fantastic Christmas period. I hope you all get to eat lots and rest and recover ahead of 2026, and we will see you back in early January. So thanks, everybody.